Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode 381. Welcome back. This week on the program, I've got a couple great papers for you. One comes out of the Illinois Lodge of Research, 2001, and we also have illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison, who stops by for another segment of the Masonic Minute. At the top of the show, I want to give a big shout out to Brother Alex Powers of the Historical Light Podcast, and he runs a great Facebook group on the history of Freemasonry. He just published his first book, 700 pages. Wow. What an accomplishment on the history of his lodge, Gardner Lodge. And Brother Alex, if you are listening to this program, congratulations. You deserve it. All the best. If you listen to Historical Light, or if you know Alex on Facebook or in the group, make sure you give him a shout out for that book. Most of us wrote our first book and we kept it around 100 pages. 700 pages for your first book is pretty huge, and what a monumental accomplishment. So again, great job, Alex. As far as new projects go, so I'm a completionist. I just can't move forward with something until something else is complete. I have some wonderful ideas for some new podcasts. Most likely they will be one-offs, seasonal, and one of them is a direct answer to something many people have been asking for. This will be a very specific, really obtuse in terms of, not stupid, a wide angle, a big objective lens on certain topics. And I'll have more about that in the future. I'll be a little bit cryptic right now. It's not totally put together. I mean, the project is going to happen, but I'm finalizing and getting together details of how we're going to do it. We are looking at another podcast as well, where we will have a more academic approach to some texts. However, that also is on hold until I finalize the first part of the project, which is to have a really exclusive release of something. You guys can be excited about that, but that's all I can say right now. I'm so sorry, but we'll build up some steam for it. And of course, there is the idea that I can't say too much about it either, because I don't want to inflate the idea and then if something falls through, have a bunch of people disappointed. So we want to make sure that it's coming, but big plans are in the mix. So we're going to get right into this paper right after this. The Whence Came You podcast is brought to you through the generous support of Masonic Revival, contemporary Masonic designs made for today's Freemason. You don't have to settle for throwing a plain old square and compass on anything anymore. Now you get something truly designed and truly wonderful, whether it's aprons, awesome pins, and wonderful neckwear. Bow ties, ties, pocket squares, you name it, Masonic Revival has it. Head on over to MasonicRevival.com and check out what they have to offer. If you use promo code WCY at checkout, that means free shipping also. And make sure if you see Brother Edgar, tell him thanks for helping bring this program to all of you. And this program is also brought to you by all of you, those of you who support this program. We can't do it without you and your donations and all of your assistance, so thank you so much. To find out more about how you can assist this program, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. There you can make direct donations, sign up to be a monthly contributor, a fellow, or even a producer. And thanks very much to everybody for donating. This piece comes from the Illinois Lodge of Research, page 23, volume number 10, came out in 1991 when our good friend, who I read a paper from the other week, Worshipful Brother Edward Rund, well, in 91 he was the Worshipful Master of the Illinois Lodge of Research, and the piece I'm going to read comes from a member of Glenview Lodge, number 1058, which is still in existence. In fact, I go there once a month. It is by William, or Will, H. Ross, PhD. The title of the paper is Alchemy, and immediately the title caught my eye. As we all know, I'm very into the esoteric and symbolic side of things, so when I hear or see the word alchemy, I'm immediately thinking about transmutative processes within the human mind, ideas of apotheosis, ideas of perfecting the human form, the human mind, the you name it, bringing gold from lead. But it seems to me, in my cursory glance at this paper, that it might not be all that it's cracked up to be, in terms of that's what it's about. So let's dive right in and hear what Will H. Ross has to say. Alchemy. Contemporary Masonic literature not infrequently refers to the science of alchemy, however erroneously so. The general understanding of alchemy continues to be that of an occult art impregnated with magic and mysticism and practiced by fakers and wizards of old. As far as the average man believes, these ancient mystics, with the sole intent of hoodwinking our meticulous and spiritually minded forefathers, practiced alchemy. The alchemist is pictured as clothed in emblazoned garments, standing over a smoking, vari-colored crucible while imploring some spirit or spiritual force to aid him in the mysterious and obviously complicated experiments to change baser metals into gold. In reality, it was the pretended art of making gold and silver, or transmuting the baser metals into the nobler ones using the arts and sciences available in the Middle Ages and beyond, which resulted in the early development of the science of chemistry. Early in the Christian era, Alexandrian Greeks practiced metallurgical arts and crafts, which were passed along to the Arabs, who introduced them to Western Europe. In its ultimate development, it was more than a vain and deluded manifestation of the thirst for gold. In its wider and truer significance, it represented the science of chemistry in the Middle Ages. Nevertheless, the idea of transmutation had a philosophical basis closely linked to the then current Greek theories of matter, wherein previously acquired empirical but disconnected data and processes were unified and focused. Leibniz, 1646 to 1716, had said, quote, that at no time was it any different from chemistry, end quote. To see why this belief was formulated, it is necessary to review alchemy's philosophical origins to realize its justifiability. Alchemy's principal object or experiment was that of producing or transmuting the base metals lead, copper, or tin into gold. To the alchemist, such changes were not only possible but also realizable as perfectly natural phenomena. Early legends had the art founded by the Egyptian god Hermes, who was credited with the development of all arts and sciences. Under the appellation Hermes Trismegistus, or Trismegistus, the alchemists attempted to attach antiquity to their claims. However, no actual documented proof that he ever practiced the art exists. Nevertheless, the description, hermetic art, and the seal of Hermes placed upon their vessels rendered the tone of antiquity desired. Incidentally, the term hermetically sealed, inferring a prevention of contamination, originated from this relationship. Arabic documents and sources attribute the art of alchemy as having passed from God to Moses and he to Aaron. Early papyri in Greek give recipes for the manipulation of base metals to form alloys which, quote-unquote, look like gold, thus allowing the artisans to utilize them in imitation jewelry manufacture. Such crafts were the exclusive monopoly of the priestly caste, who protected the arts as secret, and which in time caused them to be deluded into believing that they actually had the power to convert base metals into gold. Ancient Greece produced two great thinkers. The first men, conscious of matter's actuality, the second advanced a definition of matter. These men were, of course, Plato and Aristotle. Plato advocated that objects have no real existence but are the products of our unreliable perceptions. Plato's reasoning, though, in error, did make men conscious of the necessity for assigning a reason to matter's existence, that laws were necessary for its proper functioning. His was a philosophical foundation on which to build. Aristotle, Plato's pupil, startled the thinking world when he advanced the quote-unquote theory of forms, which was in contrast to Plato's hypothesis. Although lengthy in detail, it may be summarized as follows. All matter partakes of good, which is prima materia, or prime matter. What we actually perceive as different forms of matter, metals, salts, liquids, etc., are in fact the same identical matter that has received actuation by a junction of qualities expressed by the four Aristotelian elements, earth, air, fire, and water. It is thus that matter proceeds from the imperfect to the perfect. Men could comprehend this. From its hypothetical plane of non-existence, as Plato had defined it, a matter had been brought to the level of actuality. It existed, and it followed a plan. In light of this theory, men formulated beliefs wholly permissible concerning matter's actuality and the laws that governed it. Today, we know that these beliefs were errors in rationality, but they seemed plausible to the thinking minds of the time and were of fundamental importance in the further development of alchemy's premises. On the practical side, early writings show various recipes for coloring and gelding metals. The concept of transmutation was absent. Later writings, however, show a gradually changing attitude. The more practical parts of the recipes were either obscured or omitted. The processes for preparing alloys and coloring metals previously described in older treatises are now by mystical interpretation represented as resulting in real transmutation. The realities advanced by Aristotle had now, necessarily, to be shrouded by magical influences and Eastern astrology. This gave rise to the development of various doctrines or cults. Hylotheism, or pantheism, which advances the belief that the material universe encompasses the corporeal being of God. There is no God but matter. Agnosticism, or macrocosm to microcosm, wherein man's role in the universe or plan of things was infinitesimal, so insignificant that he could never understand that which surrounded him, for it was beyond his ken. Astrology, the art of foretelling the future of mankind by reference to the influence of the stars and planets and their various aspects and relative positions upon the course of human destiny. Animism, the theory that to matter itself is attributed a soul, a life-giving force inseparable from the very principle of its existence. The influence exerted by these beliefs was tremendous, and as alchemical knowledge accumulated, it became necessary to mask the truth by their use. Reliance fell to early Egyptian and Babylonian symbols of creation and the avowal of the philosopher's stone, whereby man, the microcosm contained within himself, elements of the universe, the macrocosm, and the identification of the planets with the metals. Even early papyri used astrological symbols for the sun and the moon, denoting gold and silver respectively, lead to Saturn, iron to Mars, copper to Venus, mercury to Mercury, and tin to Jupiter. Later development of alchemy then took place in the West rather than the East. With the spread of empire to Spain, the Arabs took the knowledge of Greek medicine and science, including alchemy, and passed it, strengthened by the infusing of strong Jewish elements, to the nations of Western Europe through Latin translations. Alchemy was a science of matter. It had its origins in the minds of the great thinkers, but it did not have its practical beginnings by then. In a world in which menial labor was abhorred, the only place where the skilled craftsmen and engineers demanded by the science lived was in ancient Egypt. The Egyptian was a religious man. His religion said that when his body died, his soul continued to reside in that body even after death. If a man was wealthy enough, he naturally desired great comforts after corporeal death and built a magnificent crypt in which his soul was to reside for eternity. These crypts were not only ornate and magnificent structures, but they were also lavishly laden internally with gleaming golden walls, heavily draped with cloths of brilliant and varied hue, studded with pieces of workmanship which are admired even today. Naturally, with such a demand for skilled workmanship, the Egyptian turned his talents toward the precious metal crafts. Gold was then, as it remains today, a rare metal, which demand has always exceeded supply, leading to the deception of disguising baser metals to appear as gold. In his attempt to discover the new methods whereby he might disguise the baser metals and thereby transmute them into gold, the alchemist developed a greater familiarity with the metals and all matter, and in doing so developed methods whereby he thought that he had actually accomplished this transmutation. If he could make a metal look like gold, then it must be gold. For wasn't all matter basically the same except for physical properties? The Egyptian influence upon alchemy was of major significance. Although it did make the science a study in deception and falsity, and produced no real theories concerning matter's plan of existence, it did have the beneficial effect of joining theory with practice for the first time. It showed men that to study matter, it must be handled, experimented with, and analyzed. From out of Egypt, alchemy spread throughout the thinking world. In Arabia, the great thinker Jabir advanced its practices. In England, Roger Bacon is said to have practiced the hermetic art. The quest for gold became almost unimaginable through long, tedious days and nights. Men toiled, risking their fortunes and their lives in the futile attempt to change base metals into the precious. As stated previously, the fundamental theory found in Greek alchemy was modified and elaborated by Arab and Latin alchemists. It theorized that all substances were composed of one primordial matter, a prima materia, to which different qualities were superimposed to obtain specific substances. This procedure for transmutation was then simple. Remove all of the physical properties to obtain prima materia itself, then merely add the appropriate qualities to get a particular substance. Prima materia was early identified with mercury, not ordinary mercury, but a special mercury of the philosophers, which was the essence or soul of mercury, freed from the four Aristotelian elements, earth, air, fire, and water, or rather from the qualities which they represented. Thus the operator had to remove from ordinary mercury the earth or earthly principle, water as the liquid principle, and fix it by taking away air or volatile principle. The prime matter thus formed had to be treated with sulfur or sulfur and arsenic to confer upon it the desired properties. Again, the sulfur used was not ordinary sulfur, but some principle derived from it, which constituted the philosopher's stone, or elixir. White for silver, gold or red for gold. Briefly then, the doctrine held that all metals were composed of mercury and sulfur with variations in composition. Thus, Vincent of Beauvais said, quote, "There are four spirits, mercury, sulfur, arsenic, and sal ammoniac, or ammonium chloride, and six bodies, gold, silver, copper, tin, lead, and iron," end quote. Of these, the first two are considered pure, the remaining four impure. Thus, pure white mercury, fixed by virtue of reaction with white non-corrosive sulfur, changes into silver. United with pure, clear red sulfur, it forms gold, while with the various kinds of impure mercury and sulfur, other metallic bodies can be produced. For example, copper is potentially silver. If one could eliminate the red color, it will be brought to the state of silver, because it is copper only in outward appearance, its inner nature being silver. Such doctrines were held in the 13th century, and were also found in the Greek alchemists. That is, everything was endowed with a particular apparent quality, but also possessed a hidden opposite quality which was rendered apparent by fire. Thus, it is obvious that these processes were neither miraculous nor supernatural. They represented natural processes extant at that time, which the alchemist reproduced in his laboratory. Attaching occult significance to the art is erroneous. However, such was the state of science at that time. There were many practitioners, especially Arabic alchemists, who doubted that the resources available at the time were adequate to the task, but strangely enough, not once in all of the surviving literature has anyone ever claimed that they actually transmuted artificial metals into identical natural ones. What is probably advanced for the occult practice resulted from some practitioners who, having gained the favors of kings, who incidentally had a strong desire to profit from the achievements of science, were rewarded by the production of large quantities of counterfeit coin. It was only later that Paracelsus gave a new direction to the art. Whereas the object of the science had heretofore been the production of gold, it was given the new direction of medicines. Increasing attention was given to the effects of various substances on the human body, examples, Arabic herbs. And this information was passed on to the men of the highest scientific culture of the time. As time did progress, through the 16th and 17th centuries, scientific thought produced other theories later proven to be false, such as the phlogiston theory. Gradually, there grew the realization that the elements, including the metals, differed intrinsically from one another. From this knowledge and data, possible groupings were formulated based on common or similar physical properties and chemical characteristics. Nevertheless, the idea that different elements are constituted by different groupings or condensations of one primal matter, which if proven true would imply the possibility of changing one element into another, has never been realized. Research has failed to yield any evidence that would support this hypothesis. What are modern-day interpretations of alchemy, and how do they relate to contemporary masonry? What of the veracity of early theories of matter compared to present-day theories? Obviating any reference to transmutation, what can be said about the early alchemical theories of matter? If we go all the way back to Lucretius, we find the first reference to the atomic structure of matter. The latest thoughts regarding atomic structure postulate similar atomic theory, except we now attach a particle nature to this structure. All matter, it conjectures, is composed of fundamental particles, electrons, protons, and neutrons combined in fixed and varying amounts. Depending upon the element, each element possesses a specific number of these basic particles, which, when added one by one to hydrogen, result in the entire panoply of elements. Each electron added to the nucleus plus the required neutrons and protons are regulated and restricted by several rules. The principle's tenet being that no two electrons in the structure can have identical quantum numbers. Quantum numbers are definite numbers, derived for atomic particles through the use of quantum mechanics, a mathematical solution to the structure of matter. Thus, electrons are paired with opposite spins, as the elements are constructed one after the other by addition of them. The energy levels of these electrons are measured by a set of sophisticated particle differential equations, calculus. According to the wave mechanics of Schrödinger, or the matrix mechanics of Dirac, which give identical values and are solved for the simplest case of an electron and proton by the use of spheric harmonics. Big calculus. Higher-ordered multi-particle solutions become too complicated even for modern computers, and then solved by perturbation techniques that make intelligent guesses about structure. The mathematics of the solutions is elegant, and in most cases complies with the experiment if the case can be solved. But when all is said and done, we don't know what we've got. For the mathematical solution cannot be reduced to a simple three-dimensional picture, but rather to a statistically derived multidimensional space having mathematical beauty but no practical viewpoint. We are left with a physical universe having a probability of existence controlled, as it were, by a complex mathematical laws exhibiting a wave-particle duality. Not a very neat picture, nor comforting. I will return to this thought later, when I discuss what all this has to do with masonry. Compare, if you would, this modern scientific concept of matter with the alchemical view. In essence, we have constructed our matter from a basic prima materia, which we identified as the hydrogen atom. Just as the alchemists built their matter by adding physical properties one after another to this basic material, so have we construed matter to consist of a gradual buildup of the several atoms by the addition of the simple building block, the electron. The discovery of radioactivity and the use of particle accelerators to convert one atom into another by the emission or adsorption of one or the other particle, a proton, another electron, a neutron, or a helium atom, approaches the object of alchemy, but certainly not the concept. Indeed, either by spontaneous emission or by nuclear bombardment with another particle, one heavy metal after another is converted to a different one. But the progression and succession, nuclear decay, invariably leads us back to lead, and not one of the precious metals. The addition, or subtraction, is one of particles, not properties. Recent scientific thought and experiment have shown that these particles are not the quote-unquote smallest, or more correctly, fundamental, but are themselves composed of smaller particles called quarks and hadrons. These particles follow a totally different set of regulations called quantum chromodynamics, and involve much stronger, larger forces called, farcically, color. In summary, it is more prudent to assert that the practice of alchemy was not an occult mystic belief, but rather an embodiment of the scientific knowledge of the time. It represented the furthest development of the physical sciences possible under those circumstances. The beliefs were less theocratic and more philosophical, and can also be considered the beginnings of the study of ideology and cosmology. What should be the Masonic interpretation and position regarding the Hermetic art? This would have to be considered as regards several viewpoints, which I would like to discuss at a later time. Alright, so this paper I found absolutely fascinating because it is now 2019. I study quantum physics and mechanics myself, and in fact I do 3 lectures on this, and what I find interesting is that the writer seems to never put 2 and 2 together. So I would say that most philosophers understand today that the process of turning lead into gold, there is the philosophical idea and the idea that perhaps this was taken literally by people studying. However, it was not literal in the works, and the people who tried to do it literally were not understanding the base idea of the alchemical process of man, right? Divesting and distilling the qualities of man down to an essence, the soul or the prima materia of the mind. So he never addresses that. The other issue that I find in the paper, which is really interesting, is he talks about this prima materia, which we know exists. And in addition, he talks about how they erroneously thought that all matter existed and was from the same source. Well, we somewhat know that now in terms of quantum entanglement. Some of the things that he referenced at the end of this paper when he talked about different spins of particles, and he mentioned Schrodinger. So when we think about the idea of quantum entanglement, it's this idea that all matter was created at the singular instance of the Big Bang, and that we've all existed for all time, always, because of the laws of thermodynamics, which state that matter can never be destroyed. It only changes form, shape, gas, solid, liquid, that kind of thing. And so the very speaker that you're listening to this program from is made of atoms and particles and matter, prima materia, that are the same atoms and particles that make up you. They've simply reformed into a vessel that holds your consciousness. Now, this isn't alchemical. This is science. All matter is the same age. It has reformed in different iterations. And so we do have the prima materia there. And then he goes on to state in this paper to mention Schrodinger. And what's interesting about this whole concept is this starts to get into something we call emergent theory. Emergent theory is really interesting. You can put this together actually with quantum entanglement, but probably more so to do with quantum entanglement. And I'm trying not to lose anybody here. I'm trying to keep this as base level as possible because that's how I understand it in all of my studies. So what this says, he talks about the probability wave. Well, that's real. In fact, the key to anything being real is a conscious mind to observe it. And so Schrodinger's cat is, if you know that, is real. Everything exists as a probability wave. And so when he earlier in the paper said that Plato and Aristotle were both wrong, and in fact Plato was wrong because he suggested something similar, it's a perception of man that matters. Well, that's true. We know that's true now. We've tested that. How can we test that? Look up the double slit experiment. Do a Google search for that. It's really cool. There's a really great video clip. I'll put the YouTube link in the show notes to the gentleman who was on the Addams Family, was Sean Astin's dad. He actually voices Mr. Physics. It's a 5-minute cartoon that everybody out there will get a kick out of, but it will help you understand quantum physics, quantum entanglement, or what we call spooky physics, and the double slit experiment. So I guess my final thoughts on this paper were that it was a fascinating expose in the practical side and how they got it wrong, but it feels like the paper's coming from the wrong direction. Although the end of the paper is where I found the most value. I really enjoyed reading about the physics and what he was talking about there. Admittedly, that is more difficult to follow if you don't have a firm foundation in understanding these types of things. And it's not for everybody, so I do apologize if I lost you. But hopefully I'll post a few links underneath, and there'll be some layman-type videos that got me started years ago that you might enjoy. And for our nerds out there who really like this, or who are listening to this right now saying, yeah, RJ, that's right, or RJ, you're fundamentally wrong, shoot me an email. It's totally cool. We can talk physics and philosophy. But in the end, it feels like what we need to do is look at the philosophy and the science, and they do come together without much effort at all. And I guess that kind of is a good plug, right? So later, in just a couple months, I'll be presenting all three quantum lectures at Victorville Lodge, number 634 in Victorville, California, on March 30th this year. So if you're out that way, check it out. We're going to go through. I'll do Esoterics 101, and it's kind of the beginning concepts about some different various occult groups that maybe were started by Masonic influences and which all kind of teach a singular lesson. And then we'll go into the Tetragrammaton, and we'll talk about the lost word as that relates into the second lecture in the quantum lecture series. So the first lecture gets us a base understanding of the idea of possible apotheosis, the idea of becoming a god. And the second part tells us a little bit more about where we have a legend about God and the Word that created all things. And the third part focuses on the spooky physics, quantum entanglement, emergent theory, all broke down, very fun, very cool, and the divine secret as it relates to all world religions. Again, is a fun set of topics. Each one is about 40 minutes. They can go longer, so if those sound great to you, but you want to just pick one for your lodge meeting or something and have me out sometime, I would be more than happy to come out. Just get a hold of me, email me at wcypodcast@gmail.com. But enough about this. Let's check out this new great segment from illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison.
Power corrupts. Absolute power, they say, corrupts absolutely. We in Freemasonry, however, elect men to whom we then hand absolute, well, nearly absolute power. Apparently, that's the way we like it. Not long ago, I had dinner with a brother who was indignant at the fact that a Grand Master had expelled an officer out of the Grand Line. "He can't do that," said the brother. "What do you mean he can't do that? He's a Grand Master." "I'm not a bylaws expert, but I believe he was well within his rights to do it. The expelled member, in fact, was appointed, not elected." I then gave the brother a couple of examples I've seen where a Grand Master and a Master of the Lodge of Research had expelled an elected member from the line. We actually had one Grand Master who said no lodge could have its own website and ordered all of them taken down. Can't do that? Of course they can, and do. Absolute power. It's practically an aphrodisiac. You've been master of your lodge? You've had it, felt it, embraced it. Some use it wisely. Some abuse it. Still, face the facts. We as Freemasons elect a benevolent, well, we hope benevolent, dictator. When I was master of my lodge, I tried to be reasonable as I swam in the seductive waters of absolute power. Oh, I made an executive decision now and then, but all in all, I think I controlled myself. Well, I controlled myself until Monday, September 20th, 2004. It was a week before Grand Lodge and 3 weeks before my final meeting as master. I had practically the entire year behind me. I had wielded absolute power with a gentle hand, but its siren song now called louder and louder. I was Clark Kent, wanting to jump into a phone booth and become Superman. I was Thor, unable to resist a pent-up urge to hurl thunderbolts. I was me, crazed, wide-eyed, and drooling, ready to unleash my venom on the innocent, unsuspecting world of my brothers. "I'm going to do it," I told myself, resigned to the criticism that would surely follow. Who cares? I'm the master. Captain Marvel, Iron Man, the Hulk, all rolled into one. I can do what I want. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. So the unremarkable meeting neared its end. Business over, the brothers sat on the sidelines ready for the standard closing. My next line that would put things in motion, Brother Senior Warden, never came. Instead, I stood and rapped my gavel on the podium 3 times. The brothers rose from their seats. I turned to my left. Brother Chaplain, you will lead us in prayer. The chaplain was a little rattled. What prayer? He whispered. The closing prayer, I said. He started out with the usual beginning, Supreme Architect of the Universe. And then he ended with his usual flourish. Then, awash in the intoxicating flood of absolute power, completely within my rights to do so, I skipped all the other closing ceremonies and said, Brethren, by the power vested in me as worshipful master, I declare Liberty Lodge number 31 duly closed. By God, I'm the master. I have the authority. I can do it that way, and I did it. Live with it. I gave a single rap of the gavel and waited for the onslaught of criticism that was about to come. I was ready. Give me your best shot. You know, sometimes in the ebb and flow of events, things don't happen exactly as we expect. Some call this the law of unintended consequences. The thing is, we usually think of that law implying a negative outcome where a positive outcome is expected. Well, something unexpected happened here, but it was the opposite. I truly had expected a negative outcome. Instead, the entire lodge erupted in cheers. Although the brothers were already standing, I think it counted as a standing ovation. Who knew giving in to the allure of absolute power could make a guy so popular? Or maybe they were just happy they could get to that second helping of dessert a little sooner. So mote it be. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison. It's the Masonic Minute.
All right, as always, huge thanks goes out to illustrious Brother Harrison for his awesome work there. Check out the WCY podcast channel on YouTube to grab the actual video of that. Share it with your lodge, maybe. Next up, I have a piece on the Midnight Freemasons called Convenient. And I thought it was a really great paper by Brother Lort, who is a law enforcement committee, Mid-State Region, Grand Lodge, FNAM in the state of New York. He sent this paper in, and I just thought it was pretty appropriate, and is as follows. Convenient. Fitting in well with a person's needs, activities, and plans involving little trouble or effort. I often think of this word as I sit in my own lodge, or another, after a long day spent juggling my schedules between part-time work, the volunteer fire service, and other work-for-free enterprises I've become involved in. Does being here involve little effort on my part? Does being here fit well into my needs and activities and plans? These are questions I am sure others must have asked themselves. Looking around, I see that I am obviously not the only one that arrived at that same conclusion. But what are the others? I wonder where Joe, Fred, James, and Charlie are. I was sure they'd be here. How curious. Maybe I should have called them. No, they would know that tonight was lodge night. They've been Masons much longer than me. Curious. I look around the lodge room at more empty seats than full ones. I look at the officers' chairs, some filled with the elected and appointed officers, some with brothers from the sidelines, acting as fill-ins. I wonder how many of the other brothers think about how convenient it is to be sitting in lodge at 7:30 at night. I rationalize that many are getting up there in years as I am. I think about those that had a nice dinner with their spouse or a significant other in the early evening and just couldn't find a reason to leave their cozy sanctuary, put on a suit and tie, go out into the cold wintry evening, and take part in an evening of fellowship. "Where is David tonight?" I inquire of our master regarding the whereabouts of our junior deacon. "Why is Brother Joe in his chair?" "No idea. I haven't heard from him," replies the master with a perplexed look on his face and a shrug of his shoulders. Joe doesn't really know that part, but I'm grateful he volunteered to fill the position for the night. The words personal responsibility pop into my head. Doing things that aren't always convenient, but because we have taken an obligation to do so and because it's the right thing to do. As I try to fill the hours between late afternoon and 7 p.m. when I leave home for lodge, I sometimes think to myself how convenient it would be to stay home in my comfy clothes, pour a glass of wine and watch something totally meaningless on the television, or perhaps taking my lovely wife out for an early dinner. About that time, my inner voice, the one that always seems to interrupt the easy way out, speaks to me. "Suck it up, Buttercup," I hear. "Remember your obligation in the second degree," reverberates in my brain. "Be a part of the solution, not a contributor to the problem," is whispered loud and clear. Once again, my all-knowing inner voice prevails. I take my shower, I put on the appropriate lodge attire, and off I go. What greets me? "Good evening, brother. How have you been? It's great to see you. Thank you so much for coming tonight," says the worshipful master as he greets everyone at the door. I again think of the convenience and personal responsibility. Are we in Masonry doing all we can to instill a degree of personal responsibility in our new brothers? Are we teaching them the importance of attending lodge, especially when given the opportunity and responsibility of taking an office? Do we strongly encourage them to find a replacement if their attendance that evening is not within the length of their cable toe? Or do we just shrug our shoulders and say, "Oh well." Right Worshipful Daniel G. Lord, Law Enforcement Committee, Mid-State Region, Grand Lodge, FNAM, State of New York. I liked the piece. When I posted it on the Midnight Freemasons, I put up a silly meme image, you know, the guy who's walking with his girlfriend, and he's kind of taken aback by another girl walking the other way, and he's got his head turned, and he's the lodge member. And his girlfriend that he's holding hands with says, "Going to the meeting." But what he's looking at is the girl on the sidelines that's labeled "Sweatpants and the Couch." And, you know, I think it got a lot of likes on Facebook and social media, but a lot of people probably, if I had the same number of people read the article than just liked it, I think it would have caused a little bit more of a stir. But I would encourage you, the next time, maybe keep this one on your phone or something, you know, and the next time you see a bunch of guys who haven't been there in a while, maybe read this one. Because, I mean, it's, let's be honest, if you read this piece in your lodge, well, you're preaching to the choir, right? I mean, I'm probably preaching to the choir right now, unless you're one of those guys who's out there who took your degrees and, you know, you're on the road. You're salesman or you're trucking or however you're doing. You're taking care of the nation in your way and, you know, we can't get along without you. You're making the world go round and you're sacrificing time away from your families and your homes to do it. We understand that. And, you know, in large part, that's why I do this podcast, is for our lodge brothers who don't always get to go to lodge. And it's just such a privilege to be able to do that. But you know those guys. Those guys who just don't go because. And maybe we should instill a little bit of value there and say to them, why aren't you coming? What is it that you're looking for that we're not providing? Because it is a two-way street. There are things that we can't do because they're not there, and they're not there because we don't do them. I think there was an Alice Cooper song, something about getting a job, but he can't because he doesn't have a car, and he can't get a car because he doesn't have a job, and so on and so forth. I probably dated myself a little bit with that one. But I think you guys all get the point. And that's it for this week. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to help support this show. How do we do that? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that today. If you head on over to WCYpodcast.com, you can click on direct donation through PayPal, which we briefly touched on in the beginning of the program. Of course, you can make that one-time donation, or you can sign up to be a monthly contributor. Contributing $2 a month, $5, or even $10 a month, whatever you choose really helps the program out. Of course, we have a limited edition shop where you can pick up any number of items that come direct from us. help us out by going to MasonicRevival.com, but also we have some other affiliates that are really important. Bankers Best, one of the most unique things we've ever done, is to work with Brother Levi Banker out of St. Louis, who owns his own company called Bankers Best Beard and Skin Care. He's been so generous. If you head to WCYpodcast.com, click on More, then click on Banker's Best, and you can check out a bunch of the different products he's got. He's got a whole line of beard care products, skin care, oils, balms, all of this stuff, and he has been doing it a long time. He knows a lot about it. Everything is handmade, quality items. We even came up with the King Solomon's Reserve Beard Balm, which is a few years old now, but remains one of the great products that he still offers. Even the artwork on the bottle was done by a brother. The nice thing about this particular product is 50% of the proceeds come back to the program. If you're a history guy like me, then you'll be pleased to know that what makes the beard oil and balm very special is that it was made utilizing the fragrances specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location, which is amazing. So black fig and honey is the formula. Luxurious scent, as Levi says, truly fit for our first grandmaster. If you use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, you'll also get a little bit of a percentage off. Please check that out. Bankers Best, or just head on over to buybankersbest.com. We also have a code with On It. You can go to our website, click on More, then go to On It, and you can click through any of the links here, or just go to onit.com and use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the program to help us out. And of course, it's business time. The book that I wrote with John T. Ruark, it is making some real waves, and people are using it and seeing success. So check that out on Amazon. You can click right to it. You can get it on Audible, Kindle, or in print, even on iBooks. And last but not least, I want to ask you to check out the Great Books program. You'll see the banner for it on the left-hand side, Intellectual Linear Progression. Use the promo code WCY, or you can just click on that link there, and you'll actually go right to the website and hear a little bit from Scott Hambrick about how awesome the program is. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoy, and thank you so much for helping us out.
Hi everyone, this is Brother Joe Martinez from Manassas Lodge number 182 in Manassas, Virginia. I first wanted to thank Brother Robert and the Whence Came You podcast for allowing me a few seconds to announce a very special event. On June 15th, 2019, we will be hosting the first ever Mid-Atlantic Esotericon in Manassas, Virginia, and tickets go on sale today. This will be a jam-packed event full of esoteric presentations from many of your favorite speakers, to include John Ruark, Frater O, Greg Kaminsky, P.D. Newman, Pierce Vaughn, Jamie Lamb, Don McAndrews, and your very own Robert Johnson. In attendance will be some of your favorite vendors and authors, which we will soon announce, and the event will include presentations for both the Master Mason, as well as those that are interested in learning more about Freemasonry and the more philosophical aspects of the craft. We will be kicking off that weekend's festivities with a social event at Sinistral Brewing Company in Old Town Manassas on the evening of June 14th. Tickets for the social event are very limited, and it will be a private event in a great venue with much fellowship to be had. If you're looking for an engaging, thought-provoking, and esoterically focused event, you will not want to miss this. Please check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/MAEsotericon for ticket links, further information, and news updates as we post them. Again, a most hearty thank you to my dear friend and brother, Robert Johnson, for allowing us a few brief minutes to tell you all about this amazing event, which we are all excited to host. Seating is limited, so get your tickets now. And as one of our co-hosts, Brother John always says, keep searching for more light. You'll be sure to find some in Northern Virginia in June of next year.
Saturday, June 15th, 2019. Your path to apotheosis starts at the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. Get your tickets. We'll see you in the Playroma.
So, I really hope you enjoyed the program. I know we had a shorter episode that last week. We got a little bit longer of one this week. Again, we've got some great guests coming up in the next few weeks. We've got news on new podcasts and new content and different things happening. All kinds of great, exciting things are coming your way this year. 2019 is going to be just fantastic. If you like Masonic podcasts, podcasts in general, I've got a lot of friends who do podcasts, and they're coming out with more and more all the time. check out the Masonic Roundtable. We go live every Thursday at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern. If you missed last week's episode, well, let me just tell you, you missed an amazing episode with Brother Joseph Wages talking about the moderns in terms of the ancient and modern split and coming together and the controversy about that, because it's not just about how they came together. It's what happened when they did and what we lost. It's really interesting. So you're going to want to check that episode out, the Masonic Roundtable, again, 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern, available on iTunes, and you can also search us for on your smart speaker, on your Amazon Echo. Download the apps both for this program, WCY or Whence Came You podcast, and also the Masonic Roundtable. If you like great articles like the ones we're reading here, I have to mention I am a huge fan, huge, huge fan of introspective work and meditation and how that relates to ancient practice. Well, one of our previous guests, author Lance Kennedy, did an article for us on the Midnight Freemasons just this last Friday, a couple days ago. It's still up if it's 9:30 at night. And if it's not, I mean, it's still up. You can just scroll back for an older post. But a wonderful article he put together and so well articulated. And I feel like he really did a great job on the symbolism of what's being expressed in the psyche. So check that out also. But again, we publish new articles Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Lots of content, guys. I hope you have an amazing week. Stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.